when I had the first ride in our purpose build, I did my mom test again, and it was like, oh, like, you know, it is more comparable to if you are in one of these airport shuttles that don't have a driver as well. You go in there and you're like, of course there's no driver. That thing is made for that, you know. So that is the same feeling that you get. You're like, man, like, let's go.
Herzlich willkommen zum OMR Silicon Valley Update, der Podcast mit Christian Bützer, der euch von deutschen Erfolgsgeschichten aus San Francisco und dem Valley berichtet.
Heute im Podcast Dr. Mark Wimmershoff. Mark ist einer der führenden Experten zum Thema Autonomous Driving. Nach seinem PhD schon vor über 10 Jahren ebenfalls im autonomen Fahren an der RWTH Aachen und Station bei VW und Audi entwickelte Mark erst direkt für Elon Musk bei Tesla den Autopilot One und wechselte dann vor ungefähr 4 Jahren zu Zoox. Ausnahmsweise ist diese Aufnahme in Englisch, damit Marks Kollegen ebenfalls etwas von der Folge haben. So, let's switch to English. When Mark joined Zoox, the company was about 40 people. Today, Zoox has more than 1,100 employees, and Mark is in charge of the AI software that lets the purpose-built vehicle take decision on how to behave and react in traffic. In this episode, we talk more about the entire self-driving industry and learn why mission, vision, and stock options are such important things in the Bay Area. But enough said, let's welcome Mark to the show. Hey, Mark. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, good to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time. Before we start, where are you at right now?
I'm actually in my bedroom because, you know, the rest of the house is taken by a wife and by my daughter, au pair. Everybody is in the house due to Corona crisis.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I'm in the garage at least, so I'm a little bit extracted from the craziness in the house.
Yeah, but it looks like you made a nice scene there in your garage.
Yeah, I should actually take a picture as well with like the wheels on the back and but yeah, so I already told people before the podcast basically a little bit about you, but you know, I always tell people when I talk about my friends in Silicon Valley that you are the one that kind of was the first person that I actually met when I moved here 8 years ago, because we both moved here in a very similar time frame, and you made all these different steps in your career, and it's super impressive. But today you work at Zoox, one of the, as I understand, leading companies when it comes to autonomous driving. And so maybe you can start us and tell us a little bit about like what Zoox is, what are you doing exactly there, and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So I work at Zoox, what is it now, like since 4.5 years. Zoox is building an autonomous vehicle from the ground up. So basically, we don't believe that you can just bolt additional sensors and some additional other pieces to an existing vehicle platform and call it then, here, this is my autonomous vehicle. So we build a purpose-built robot, that's how we call it, to transport people from A to B. And with that, next to building that vehicle platform, we of course also have to work on the software, the sensors and the compute to make that vision reality. And I work in the software team. Mm-hmm. And then more specific in the software team, I'm leading the planning and control team. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? So planning and control basically guides the vehicle through the traffic, right? So on the highest level, you can say we have like a Google Maps kind of planner, you know, like how do I get from A to B? That is then defines the route, because our mission planner. And once you know which route you want to take, the vehicle starts moving and needs to make decisions, right? So should I follow that vehicle? Should I do a lane change and go around it? Do I want to stop for that pedestrian or nudge around that pedestrian? How do I yield? What do I do with the traffic lights? So all these decisions are being made in the planning stack, and we take inputs from a variety of other systems, like our perception stack, our prediction stack, localization stack, and you also have tail operations. If you want, you can also.
And you got into this fairly early, right? Didn't you like do your PhD basically in autonomous driving back like many years ago in Aachen?
Yeah, more or less. So I always say I'm the accepted automotive dude in the software environment. So I actually by trade I'm a mechanical engineer. Then specialized in automotive engineering. And then in automotive engineering, I went into the driver assistance systems. So, you know, instead of working on the next chassis version, I joined the people who bolted radar sensors in front of the vehicle and started driving around and saw like, man, cool, we can perceive our environment. And, oh, now we can actually write a controller so that we don't have to accelerate or decelerate anymore. You know, like this is how adaptive cruise control came up. And then it grew to autonomous driving.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if you go back in Germany, I read this article that actually in 1968, some guy at Mercedes already, like, I think Ernst Dickmann or so was his name, that he already kind of invented the autonomous driving in some sense. Was this something that inspired you back then already? So that there was this thought, okay, this is what I want to work on? Or was it literally just a coincidence that someone had a radar sensor and you put it on?
I wish I would be so thoroughly thought through. For me... So I read the same article that you read, and I only found that article once I was doing my first mini thesis, where you have to, you know, document and that stuff. For me, it was literally a little bit of a coincidence, because I always worked next to school and next to university. And I did a bunch of jobs like that. We could talk a lot about that, but let's take that for a later time. And then, you know, like once in Germany, you have like pre-diploma and diploma, which is now bachelor master. Once I had basically bachelor done and was at master, I was looking for that first mini thesis. And then somebody told me, hey, you know, like at IKA, there's somebody bolting radars in front of the car and you drive around and then you can program something to make use of that data. I was like, oh, that sounds pretty cool. What is that? So I went there and asked for that mini thesis, and that's how I got started. And then, you know, quit the jobs next to my studies that were not related to my actual field, and then also started to work there, and then did at the same company the PhD.
And then how did you actually move over to the US? I mean, like you worked on this like topic in Germany, but then what made this switch happen?
During my time at the university, I wanted to have an adventure and go abroad, you know, like, oh, I thought like, oh, before I finish my studies, I want to go abroad and experience something. So everybody said go west, which would be from Germany's side, go to America. And I was like, okay, everybody says go west, you know what, I will go east then. So, and that's why I went to the Tsinghua University in Beijing for 6 months. And that was, you know, like an awesome experience, I have to say. So recommendation for everybody, you know, doing studies, use the time and just get out, because in this six months, I learned so much, got to know so many new people, right? You literally arrive, you don't know anything, right? You don't know, how to get a cab and what to tell to that taxi driver, and by the time you leave, like you have a farewell party, have so many new connections, learned so much stuff also then at the university. Yeah, but fast forward, you know, like then I went back to Germany, did my PhD. And once I had line of sight of being done with my PhD in Germany, I was like, oh, like I'm not ready yet to settle down, you know, because I was like in this very German mindset of, I will go to a German OEM. And then I will stay there forever, right?
Like, yeah, but you did work for Audi, right?
And yes, for a while. Yes. So while I did my PhD, I also, you know, like my boss came once to a team meeting and said, like, okay, can somebody take on the connection with the Volkswagen Electronics Research Lab in Belmont, because they we wanted to build up like an internship program
and,
with
and
them.
And Belmont is here in California, right?
Yeah, like Belmont here in California. Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Like in the Bay Area here. So, and in my head, there was already, man, like, I kind of want to go to California, you know? So I was like, I take that on and I will send, you know, like good people there. So that's how I got in touch with them, sent, I think, two or three good students there. Yeah, and then once I saw the line of sight of being done with my PhD thesis, I just reached out to them and said, like, hey, you know, like, I think you like the interns I send, and I'm about to finish my PhD program, so how about I come over as well, yeah. and have another adventure. And the master plan was go here for like 2 or 3 years, stay at like it was the Volkswagen Group is the electronics research lab. That means for Audi and also Bentley and whatnot is in there. Mm-hmm. But then it came actually everything differently.
Yeah. And then you worked for them for a while here, and then Tesla knocked on the door, right?
Yeah, so I worked for them like only a year here, because at that time also Tesla Autopilot Group like started out, and then a recruiter actually reached out and said like, hey, your background fits amazing, like why don't you come over? Yeah. And in my German mindset, I was like at first like, oh, why would I do that? You know, like yeah. I am at the OEM, right? So, and Tesla is still fairly small in comparison to these OEMs. So, but then I got to know more about Tesla, and also the recruiter did a very good job, I have to say. Mm-hmm. She's actually now also with Zooks.
Great.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, after a year, I said, like, okay, you know what? I tried out and I jumped over to Tesla, and I think we were only like a handful of people in the Autopilot group in the beginning, and had to do a lot of catch-up work at first with all the standard driver assistance systems for the Model S, and then go beyond state-of-the-art and push out then Autopilot 1.
Yeah, yeah, I remember this really well because we were skiing back then in Whistler, I think. And then we were sitting in the lift, you know, the first lift in the morning. We were queuing up at 8 a.m. to be really the first one on the hill. And then who you know, your phone rings, you open your Apple Watch back then, and it says Elon calling. And that was like a crazy time for you, right? Like, didn't you like spend a lot of time directly face on face with him? And then like he kind of sensed your talent in a sense, and then kind of grabbed you, and you had to work like really crazy hours, and but also learned a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that summarizes it pretty well. It was you look back, it was a pretty fun time. Exhausting, but fun time, learned a lot. And I mean, Elon is very hands-on, I would say. So I think like a lot of engineers actually interact directly with him. Especially the last 6 months before Autopilot 1 released, very closely with him. Basically, had to send updates every day. I think every week we had like a drive in the car. Every week we had like one-on-ones about the status of Autopilot. Yeah, it was exhausting, but learned a lot. And yeah, like I'm happy that we pushed it out at that time.
Yeah, and then, I mean, and then Zooks came around the corner, right? And that was basically shortly after they were also founded, right? You were one of the first employees pretty much when Zooks started out.
Yeah, I mean, when I joined, we were already, what is it, like around like 40 people, something like that, at Zooks. And I mean, I actually heard of Zooks already when I was working at Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. Because then Tim Cantley-Clay, he was still in Australia at that time.
Who was the founder?
Exactly. Kind of like, yes, founder, one of the founders of Zooks. he was still in Australia, so he came over after that. But we met at a conference in Germany, in Berlin. I still have his old business card. And he was telling all these stories about, you know, like, oh, how does that autonomous vehicle have to look like, you know, like bi-directional and whatnot, and how the interior would be really ergonomic for that purpose. And
And frankly, he is a designer, right? So he was thinking a lot about like the experience rather than the actual technology.
Yes. Yeah. So and that was what was in my head, you know. I was like, man, you're like, I really appreciate your thoughts, but... at first, we have to solve all that technology challenges, right? But then I actually went out with a friend of mine for a beer, and he told me, like, oh, did you hear there's a new robo-taxi startup on, he said, Stanford campus. It's not exactly Stanford campus, but it was close enough, you know. And the name is Zooks. I was like, Zooks, wait, that's like the guy from Australia. And then I started to research, and then I found out, oh, Jesse is also with it. Like, that has to be legit, you know? Mm-hmm.
And Jesse, remind me who Jesse was?
Jesse is our CTO. So he was leading then after Sebastian Thrun, who, you know, is the father of like all the Google autonomous driving stuff, or one of the fathers there. So Jesse then at Stanford actually took over the autonomous driving program. Mm-hmm. And then he coupled up with TKK to actually do Zooks. Mm-hmm. So that is what I found out. I had then a lot of chats with him, was really like inspired and bought in by these two, and thought, man, with these guys, you can, you know, go through the waves and the roller coaster rides of a startup. So I jumped.
Yeah, and I mean, it's crazy. Like right now, you're more than 1,000 people, I think, or at least I read that. So tell me a little bit more about Zooks, about like what you're trying to accomplish there, right? You already talked about like building something from the ground up and building like a self-driving vehicle that essentially also has like this nice looking experience. But what is the vision of the company in the end there?
Yeah, so the vision is basically that we want to offer mobility as a service, right? So you have an app, you say, I am here and I want to go there. Mm-hmm. And then our purpose-built vehicle will pull up, pick you up, and you should just enjoy the ride, you know, like continue doing whatever you are doing. Don't get distracted by anything. In the end, we want to offer the mobility as a service built from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically you kind of skip all the steps that some other companies do in between, right? Like think of Uber or Lyft or all those. Or in Germany, there's now this from Volkswagen, this big gold bus that drives around in Hannover and in Hamburg, where they also have an electric vehicle, but there's still a driver. So you also have your app and the car is coming up. But you basically skip all those steps and kind of work on that future vision that maybe other companies also have, but they do kind of a detour in a sense.
I would not say it is necessarily a detour, and because I think if you look at Uber, Lyft, right? So their initial model was not immediately to do the autonomous driving piece, right? So for them, it was like, hey, there are a lot of people out there who want to offer rides. So why not creating a platform so that, you know, these people could find other people who want to get a ride?
Yeah.
The most expensive piece in the equation is the human operator, right? So now that is then also what led to that these companies started to do their own efforts into the autonomous driving direction. For us, you know, we also have a fairly big, we call it L3 fleet, like level 3 autonomy fleet up in the city, like San Francisco, also driving Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
These fleet vehicles basically do more or less the same as you would have in an lift over vehicle. You know, there's still a human driver in there, yeah. but it has an autonomous driving stack.
Yeah.
And it drives then from A to B to C to D and collects data, right?
I mean, I see these cars all the time, and there's always obviously a driver, as you say, but they always also hold the steering wheel in their hands. I guess that's kind of a legal requirement, but actually they just hold it and sit there, and then the car is still driving itself. Is that what happens? Or?
Yeah, so, you know, like, because the these are still safety drivers, right? So, and by protocol, they are asked to hold the hands close to the steering wheel, right? Because mm-hmm. what you want to reduce is, of course, reaction time in case something happens.
Yeah.
So this is why if you see that, then we actually did our job right. Not that the guy is like always driving, but we ask the drivers, have your hands close to the steering wheel so that mm-hmm. you can, if you have to take over quickly, then you are able to.
So let's talk a little bit about these levels. You just said that, you know, there's like this level 3, that there's some conditional automation in place, but there's still a driver. Where do you see, so I think 4 is like this high automation, right? And then 5 is kind of the vision and future that everyone wants to go to, where everything is fully autonomous. When do you think that we will reach that level that, you know, literally I can pull out my phone, I can get the car? Like, is that something that is really, really far out? Or do you think like in the next 1 to 2 years, I'd be able to use such service in a city like San Francisco?
Yeah, so I think we see it like, you know, we will not wake up one day and a magic switch flipped and wow, yeah. now it's like right there in the city, right? So
yeah.
For us, it's about, we want to go step by step. So mm-hmm. that means, at first, we want to bring our purpose-built vehicle to the public road, right?
Mm-hmm. So one question in between. Yeah. But like this, you said this multiple times now. Purpose-built vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean with purpose-built? It's just that it doesn't look actually like a car, but it's just built for the purpose of transporting. Is that why you use that specific phrase?
Yeah. So purpose-built vehicle is purposefully built for the autonomous driving, for transporting people autonomously from A to B.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is, yeah, like as mentioned, like a completely re-architected, rethought from the architecture. How does a vehicle or robot have to look if there's no driver, right? Because then, you know, like if you don't have a driver's seat, like, wait, so you don't have a steering wheel, you don't have pedals. So why is everybody looking into the same direction? Is that actually necessary? And then can you make you better use of that room that you would gain? And how can you make a better experience? You know, like they're actually like a funny story, perhaps, you know. I frequently do like... you know, I don't know if my mom will hear that, but I freaking do my mom test, right? Which is whenever I deal with a piece of new technology, mm-hmm. I try to imagine my mom has to use it. You know,
So now we
actually did some driverless drives on a campus, and which was a re-equipped vehicle. And you know, you're sitting
re-equipped means re-equipped. An existing vehicle with like sensors on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So you still have like a steering wheel there, right? And you mm-hmm. still have the feeling like, hey, I'm sitting in that car, but then you're like, man, something is missing. The driver is missing, right? Like, so, and then I did my mom test, and then I was like, yeah, I think my mom would be like very distracted by that, you know, I am actually in a vehicle that was made for a human driver, but yeah. now it's like re-equipped. When I had the first ride in our purpose-built, that is again the phrase, right? In our purpose-built vehicle, I did my mom test again, and it was like, it is more comparable to if you are in one of these airport shuttles. That don't have a driver as well, You go in there and you're like, of course there's no driver. That thing is made for that, you know.
That is the same
feeling that you get. You're like, man, like let's go, right? That thing is, you know, let's go.
It creates probably a completely different level of trust, right?
Yes, exactly. So yeah, that is a thing I did there. But we got sidetracked somehow. What was the
I actually wanted to talk about that. So another area that I'm interested in is really like how this will change the overall the car industry, right? Like right now in urban areas like San Francisco or any large city, of course, parking is expensive, but then some people still want their own car. Once a service like this rolls out, do you see that then suddenly all the old OEMs like really struggle, or will there still be like this mix and it will only replace the taxis and Ubers and all of those transportation methods? And maybe it replaces the buses and the tubes and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I see it like that. So fast forwarding to once we have that technology available, I see it that especially in the inner city, I mean, we kind of see it already a little bit with Lyft and Uber. It will change more that people will not own as many vehicles anymore as they do. That is my view on things. But, you know, even for that technology, you still need vehicle platforms, right? And I think the OEMs, what they can do very good is to actually build vehicles. This is why, I mean, that ability that OEMs have is, you know, will still be needed, maybe in different amounts, perhaps. But yeah, that is certainly be needed.
But isn't there then also a way where Zoox could just be the technology provider? I mean, couldn't you create much more leverage if let's say an Audi or BMW or Mercedes, you know, like the brands that are known for the great haptics, like every button press is amazing and every like spalt mass, like the gaps between the panels is supposedly perfect. But you know, as you said, right, like in the beginning, Zoox was a lot about also the design and experience. Isn't there a way also to partner with those companies then?
I mean, of course, there are ways for that. And a lot of is thinkable in these directions, right? If you ask me, what, you know, having seen Tesla from the inside, where everything is very integrated, you know, like software components, the hardware components, the vehicle development itself, that is, you know, where a lot of fast development happens, right? That is, I think, also one of the thoughts why we started out in that way, that we, hey, let's do that whole integrated approach. But sure, you know, like nobody knows what the future brings. So there are different paths thinkable where you could leverage also other companies who have knowledge in some directions.
And then legislation, of course, is a huge issue, right? Like there's still these, I mean, every time a self-driving car hits or some self-driving component was involved and there's a little accident, there's a huge news report. And I remember the beginning specifically when Tesla rolled out Autopilot 1, their stock price went up and down by like 10% if there was like one crash. And no one ever talks about all the lives that were saved because of autonomous driving being actually much safer, probably in many regards already today. But like, I mean, in some countries, in some cities, they're super open or it's also easier to drive. Like I see some cities in the US where many car fleets from a bunch of startups are on the road, but then you have these very narrow, very hilly streets like San Francisco and all like, and then you go to Germany, probably where legislation is even harder in general. Like, how do you think that will change, or are you guys lobbying in a sense a lot to drive this forward, because it's probably not happening just by itself, right?
I mean, what we try to do there is we try to lead with a good example, so we are in very close cooperation with relevant parties. So for example, we also have Mark Roskind, who is our chief safety innovation officer. Mark Roskind actually ran under Obama, like NHTSA. And I think he was even actually leading the one of the Tesla autopilot investigators, but whatever. But we definitely are very engaged in that direction and also want to help legislation to understand, you know, like the technology, the limitations, the challenges, and yeah, then lead there with a good example, so that together we can come there to a good framework that we can use then in the future.
And do you see other big challenges also? I mean, next to the legislation, of course, but like to bring these into the market, right? There's, of course, you know, people need to hear about it, you know, just pushing something out. I always remember these price fights between Lyft and Uber when it first started. Obviously, there are more companies than just Zoox that have like similar concepts. What are the biggest challenges to bring this to life in the end?
What I see as the biggest challenges is, you know, like, how do you know like that good is good enough? You know, like when is it good enough, right? So that I think is looking towards like the safety case, so that you know I am ready to launch, right? So like if you try to, you know, like try the self experiment, everybody thinks I'm a good driver, right? But what is actually good driving? How do you measure good driving? How do you measure safe driving? And what are the edge cases that we deal with? And how do we make sure that that technology is really ready to, you know, like pull the plug, boom? I always describe it to my team, you know, like, that we have to build that technology so that we can pull the plug, actually go home, then fall asleep. You know, like we have to be able to sleep, right? And then you wake up next morning and you are like,
and hey, no
like,
one is dead.
And you also feel yourself good with that, right? So is like, no, there's no recipe, no existing recipe for that. Like, hey, you have to do A, B, C, and D to get there, right? So that is like one of the big challenges that I see. And you know, like the world has so many possible scenarios, and that is what we see from our everyday driving in San Francisco. I mean, people are crazy, right? So I mean, that is also the good thing why we drive in San Francisco, that you see like per mile you see a lot more craziness than if you would drive in other environments, right? So this is where you do really like stress test and see situations where you're like, okay, like if I would have been asked to come up with a crazy realistic situation, you see a situation where you're like, man, I would not have expected that would even be realistic and possible, you know, that people do stuff like that, you know.
I mean, I see this. I mean, right now, of course, we're not commuting as much, but like on my way to work every day, someone like just jumps out of a garage or a car suddenly pulls up, or they open doors or whatever, right? I mean, that's interesting. So do you think when a lot of these cars, like the more autonomous cars drive, the more they also talk to each other and the safer it gets, and there's even some standard almost, right? Like when computer systems came alive and they were like PDFs, so like every computer was able to read this. Is that something that you guys also think about then?
I mean, I think it will get problematic if it's if it goes across the board of different manufacturers, right? Because there's always like, okay, how do we standardize that protocol? I remember there are like standardization efforts for like vehicle-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. I think for us, we certainly have like our internal communication for our vehicles to our infrastructure, and the infrastructure can talk to the other vehicles then and inform you like, hey, there's a construction zone, so either don't take that lane or like avoid that zone completely, right? So we definitely have these abilities. Now to grow beyond that, I think that it'll come sooner or later. But it will take a little bit extra time because, you know, I think now we are still in the phase where like, to figure out like what is it exactly that we need, you know? And then once you figure that out, you can then, you know, like open it up to like going beyond from manufacturer to manufacturer, and exchange data there. But yeah, that, I think that will take a little longer, I would say, because then you also need to see, oh, I got some data from an external provider. Now, how do I know that I can trust that? So you need to, you know, like certify that, and you don't want to, you know, be prone to, oh, somebody just sends fake stuff to our vehicle. So that opens up a whole different story that you now need to worry about. From whom do you get all that data? How is the authentication done?
Mm. And do you think that those services like Zoox eventually will also be available in, you know, smaller cities? I mean, in a large city where space is limited, where it's expensive to park your car, where, you know, I mean, even if I go to work, there isn't even parking available in some sense, right? Like, of course, in those scenarios, it is super, like, clear. Do you think this will also be a broad thing that just kind of everyone will be able to use such service eventually?
Oh, yeah. I mean, totally, right? Like, I mean, have a look at the ride-sharing companies today, right? So they're mm-hmm. also available everywhere, right? So I personally, like, not doing shelter in place, but usually also go once or twice a week up to San Francisco. So I also take an Uber from home here, Uber or Lyft from home. And yeah, I also don't live in the city, so more in the suburbs. I totally think that it will, you know, maybe not from day one, but it will grow certainly into these areas as well.
And do you think that, I mean, these times are special, right? With shelter in place, and no one likes to touch anything that is not their own, or, you know, like the ride sharing, like the bikes and the scooters that are parked on the street. Now that when you just see them, you have this mind, or this picture in mind of all these germs sitting on the handlebar. Do you think that that will be another challenge also going forward, where people just don't feel comfortable by using something that isn't their own, that actually the car manufacturers will see another uptick, because everyone that didn't want a car themselves now is like, no, I really want my own car because I don't want to get sick, and I will always be like in a protective environment?
I mean, I haven't thought about it in that way. I have thought about it more in the way of, you know, if you with this, like, oh my god, everywhere is a germ, right? If I want to avoid other humans, right? Like, yeah. if you think it from that way, and you need to have transportation, and you would have the choice: do I order a transportation device with a human in there or without a human in there? I think then you would choose, like, you know, like, it's better to not have an unknown human in there, to avoid more germs or virus spread. So I think if we would have our technology today, it would actually be fantastic, right? Yeah.
It would probably explode then even.
Yeah, exactly, right? But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thought if that, you know, it would certainly be good for the car manufacturers if people think that way. I would frame it more like, I think at the moment, you know, like, people think about a lot of other pieces, because I mean, sadly, that crisis also like hits people losing their jobs and so on. So I think the last thing at the moment they might think about is like, do I want to buy a car or not?
No, of course, it's more like once they are back, and then they think about like, what if this happens again, right? So this podcast is also mostly about, you know, Germans living in the Bay Area, right? And like these mm-hmm. stories behind it. And we learned a lot about you and how you got here. And
I kind of, you know, now I have a very Texan accent.
In Germany, you actually have the best accent of all of this. Unfortunately, we do this in English. But, you know, living as a German in the Bay Area, what do you feel are like the biggest differences work-wise, maybe also in the private life that you see?
I mean, I learned to love the startup environment, you know, which is, you know, like everybody who joins there is like really passionate about the mission, right? It's people join for the mission. that company, if you look at it today, you know, it's a little bit like, if you buy a house, right? So some people have this view for the house itself now might look not good, right? Mm-hmm. Or like not really finished, but you already have like all the things in your head, like, man, we do this and then we build something over there. And, you know, like it is a great location. So that house has a great future, right? So, and this is how like you look at startups here, right? So this is how I got to know Zoox, and I was like, man, that thing has potential, right? And then, I mean, obviously also with like this, that employees get equity in the company.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody is bought in, you know, it's less of, it's a different climate. I would say different work climate, which, that everybody is literally like, we are in this together, right? Because everybody has equity in the company and wants to move as fast as possible towards the goal line. And
It's interesting when you have this in Germany, that discussion, even with startups, the average German, I would say, a lot of times is more like, can I not have more salary? I don't want the equity because that's like kind of uncertain. So would you agree that that is a huge difference where here, especially in the Valley, everyone is like, as you just said, right, like behind the mission and the vision. And that's not something that maybe is so clear for many Germans.
I think it also has a lot to do with like how you grow up, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. Growing up there in Germany, I mean, I didn't even know anything about like, oh, you can get equity in a company and that grows then, right? So I think people just don't know about it. But then, go back to that example of like, hey, have a look at that company or that young company, then that startup. Compare it to like that house that you might see, you know, like and see how much potential is in there and how much more value do you think you can create over the years. And then it actually, if you believe, man, that could actually work out, then it makes sense to like rely on the equity. You know, I mean, yes, it is a little bit gambling and a lot of paper money. It can go up and down, right?
Yeah, sure.
But that is what keeps also like people engaged and motivated in that company, right?
Yeah. But is that a legal issue that those programs are just not as easily to be set up in? I mean, we are both probably not experts in that. But I also was lucky that I always worked for American companies. So from literally the first day in my work life, there was always like, here are your stock options. And thankfully that I worked out also. But like in university, even though I did study business, we never talked about this even once, right? Like just by motivating people through that little thing, how that changes is actually quite interesting, I think.
Yeah. No, I think so too, right? And I think that is like looking back, I would wish that there would be like more education in Germany in that direction, because I think Germany has like really brilliant engineers, right? Like I really do think the engineering quality in Germany is really high, but somehow I mean might have changed over the last years, but somehow for me it felt like we grew up always with the hey, you have to go to a big company and you stay there for 20, 30, 40 years and then you get a nice watch or something.
and a company car, right?
and then that's it, right? So it was never about like, man, what if you're young, you know, and you have ideas, that's the time to try them out, right? Like you will learn a lot. You will widen your horizon. It really gives you back also a lot.
Cool. Mark, thank you so much for all these insights into your work at Zoox, your life, how you got there. It was super exciting to hear. Thanks for sharing all of that.
Yeah, not a problem. Always happy to do so.
Yeah, take care. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you for taking the time, Christian.
Yeah,
talk
see
to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, das war die zweite Folge vom OMR Silicon Valley Update. Nochmals die Bitte, falls euch der Podcast gefallen haben sollte, abonniert ihn doch und wenn ihr mir eine Riesenfreude machen wollt, bewertet den Podcast direkt im iTunes Store. Und zum Schluss wie immer noch ein kleiner Tipp, folgt mir bei LinkedIn und abonniert dort einfach den OMR Silicon Valley Update Newsletter, um keine Folge zu verpassen. Wir hören uns in 2 Wochen. Ich freue mich.